erased from the memory of justice-seeking people around the world. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. Stay tuned for more. Tasnim News Agency wrote, the 40th anniversary of Sabra and Shatila massacre by the Zionist regime was marked by Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Kanani. In a post on Instagram, the Iranian diplomat stressed that the apartheid Zionist regime, which was established on the basis of aggression, crimes, and blatant violations of international law and human rights, continues to pose a threat to world peace and security. September 16th marks the anniversary of the 3 days of crimes that resulted in an atrocious and inconceivable slaughter of Palestinian refugees at the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps in southern Beirut at the hands of the Zionist regime and its accomplices, which wasn't the false regime's first or final crime either. It was one of the most harrowing massacres committed in the Lebanese Civil War, a conflict known for its brutality. Shatila, a Palestinian refugee camp, and the adjacent neighborhood of Sabra are located southwest of Lebanon's capital city, Beirut. The refugees were victims of the 1948 Nakba, or catastrophe in Arabic, fleeing the violent ethnic cleansing of Palestine by Zionist militias as Israel was formed. But between September 16th and 18th, 1982, the refugees now living in Shatila and Sabra, along with Lebanese civilians, were attacked by a right-wing Lebanese militia in coordination with the Zionist regime army. Between 2,000 and 3,500 people were killed. Middle East Eye also wrote, the month of September has come to represent a series of historical devastations for the Palestinian people and their struggle. Commemoration of the sharp betrayals and travesties contained within these short 4 weeks is a painful ritual through which Palestinians reflect upon the continuing need for liberation. Moreover, it is a time to consider various ways freedom has continued to be denied and sabotaged by settler, colonial, and imperial violence of the Zionist regime. As if this weren't staggering enough, September 16th to 18th also marks the 40th anniversary of Sabra and Shatila massacre. The massacre was supported by the Zionist regime occupation forces, which had invaded and occupied Lebanon in an attempt to drive out the Palestinian resistance, and carried out with the full knowledge and intentional inaction of the United States. The ensuing bloodbath came on the heels of the U.S. imperialist Reagan Plan, a policy by which Washington dismissed the need for Palestinian statehood in favor of successful normalization with Israel, as central to fulfilling UN Security Resolution 242, and demanded that Jordan speak on behalf of the Palestinians in negotiations. This cruel juxtaposition reveals the overlap between the physical brutality of colonial murder and the political disempowerment that oppressive forces like the settler colonial U.S. apply to the global South in pursuance of geo-imperial domination. Following the massacre, the Zionist regime occupation authorities released the Kahan Commission report, which, as Palestinian intellectual Stephen Salaita argues, followed a larger pattern of colonial self-acquittal. Notably, the Kahan Commission report was celebrated by liberal imperialist corporate media outlets like New York Times. The legacy of Sabra and Shatila, in which victims were killed with impunity, remains four decades later, mirrored by what Israeli regime colonial authorities did after occupation forces assassinated Palestinian reporter Shirin Abu Aqile. U.S. President Joe Biden couldn't even be bothered to learn how to pronounce her name properly. But as reflected in the work of Robert Fisk, the Sabra and Shatila massacre also galvanized a new oppositional journalistic ethos that challenged the Zionist use of terrorism as a pretext for mass slaughter and false accusations of anti-Semitism against those defending Palestinian and Lebanese people murdered by local fascists with the help of Israeli regime occupation forces and a U.S. seal of approval. The total death toll is presumed to be anywhere from 800 to 2,000 Palestinians and at least 100 Lebanese. However, as historian Rashid Khalidi notes, because the Lebanese forces abducted many people who were never found, the complete number of victims may never be fully known. In the aftermath of Sabra and Shatila, journalists, for the first time, could directly transmit the horrors they confronted on the ground without pressure from their employers. It is, in this sense, that the massacre created a shift in how reporters and activists challenge the dominant narrative on Palestine. Today, Palestinians are able to bypass mainstream outlets and call attention to Zionist violence through social media, as we saw in May 2021, when activists in Sheikh Jarrah shared their stories and struggles with the world. Though Silicon Valley tech giants insidiously continue to practice digital apartheid against Palestinians, no amount of deletions can ever take away what the world has already seen.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Oil and gas, two commodities that have been at the center of news for months now, mainly due to the conflict in Ukraine. One of the criticisms leveled against these oil and gas giants are the record profits that they are raking in.
It is immoral for oil and gas companies to be making record profits from this energy crisis on the back of the poorest people and communities and at a massive cost to the climate.
Bombshell report, however, is putting the spotlight more on these oil companies, but for the wrong reasons. Like this headline. Criticism intensifies after Big Oil admits gaslighting public over green aims, which goes on to say, fury as explosive files reveal largest oil companies contradicted public statements and wished bedbugs upon critical activists. Like this one.
And here today, we're going to be out demanding that the City of London, which is responsible or oversees about 15% of fossil fuel funding, could actually very, very rapidly, you know, get this source of finance switched off and move towards a green economy.
Here are the opening statements of the Oversight Committee.
Today we are holding our third hearing in the committee's investigation into the fossil fuel industry's decades-long climate disinformation and greenwashing campaigns.
Big oil, namely ExxonMobil, Chevron, Shell, and BP, are at the center of controversy again and yet again, lying about keeping in line with climate change restrictions.
But these executives refused to commit to real changes.
What kind of lies? Here's one example.
But it is more than having to change. We want to change. We want to change because it's the right thing for the world, and it's a tremendous business opportunity for BP.
It was not too long ago when these headlines and pictures were plastered on the front pages of newspapers around the world. Climate change alarm, code red for humanity. Yet these alarm bells fail to stop these big oil companies from advancing their agenda, making money at the expense of people for their shareholders. While these companies are making record profits, it is worth noting the economic costs of climate change. The global cost of adapting to the climate impacts is expected to grow $140 to $300 billion per year by the year 2030 and $280 to $500 billion per year by the year 2050. To get the full impact of what these energy conglomerates are doing, the bare facts need to be known. According to a report published by the Carbon Majors Database in 2017, just 100 of them have been the source of more than 70% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions since the year 1988. If fossil fuels continue to be extracted at the same rate over the next 28 years as they were between 1988 and 2017, global temperatures would rise by 4 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. What is shocking is that these large corporations, like Exxon, knew about climate change almost 50 years ago. In 2015, it was revealed that Exxon understood the science before it became a public issue. It was called the Climate Deception Dossiers.
The reality of global warming began making front-page headlines nearly 30 years ago. That's when the world's largest fossil fuel companies launched a three-decade campaign to deceive the public and delay action on climate change.
The worst part about these findings was that ExxonMobil spent millions of dollars to promote misinformation about the issue. The goal? To sow doubt about climate change. Let that sink in. Because these dossiers revealed that the coalition of fossil fuel companies had launched a big communications effort to sow doubt. Their motto, victory will be achieved when the average person is uncertain about climate science. Then in 2019, it was reported that major global firms were accused of concealing their environmental impact. This included more than 700 companies like Facebook, Amazon, Tesco, and here we go again, ExxonMobil. They were accused of lacking transparency over things like water shortages and deforestation. How these non-oil and gas companies do this is that they do what's called greenwashing, conveying a false impression that one's products are environmentally friendly or sound, when, in essence, they are not. And here are some of the companies that are guilty of this. Famous brands, known the world over, claiming that they have gone green, but in essence, they have not. Whether it was the Paris Climate Accord or COP26.
And we arrive at what I believe is the moment of truth.
Or John Kerry.
It is time to come together for future generations in ways that none of us really ever thought we might have an opportunity to do.
All of that appears to be on the shelf for now. With a lack of energy resources, European countries and the U.S. are scrambling to fill the shortages, even if it includes resorting to big CO2 emitters like fossil fuels. On the surface, this is legislation that the U.S. is passing through Congress to, in short, stop African countries from associating with Russia, especially when it comes to business activities. But looking deeper, this is what many call the U.S. bullying other countries into submission. That is how the South African president is viewing this, urging the U.S. to not punish African nations by pressuring them to cut ties with Moscow. Cyril Ramaphosa realizes the dangers behind this legislation. He has said that this measure will harm Africa and marginalize the continent. We should not be told by anyone who we can associate with. When it comes to Russia, many African countries feel the same. For example, when a UN voting took place for sanctions to be imposed on Russia, 17 African countries abstained from the UN vote. The U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, had to come out and defend U.S. interests in Africa, stating that U.S. intentions are not to dictate what African nations should do.
Too often, African nations have been treated as instruments of other nations' progress rather than the authors of their own. Time and again, they have been told to pick a side in great power contests that feel far removed from daily struggles of their people. The United States will not dictate Africa's choices. Neither should anyone else.
The source of this aggressive U.S. legislation dates back years ago. During the tenure of the former U.S. President Donald Trump, the U.S. unveiled a new Africa policy to counter what it called predatory Russia and China. This was unveiled by the former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton, who said that the U.S. was losing ground to China and Russia.
The predatory practices pursued by China and Russia stunt economic growth in Africa, threaten the financial independence of African nations, inhibit opportunities for U.S. investment, interfere with U.S. military operations, and pose a significant threat to U.S. national security interests.
Yet Bolton was not forthright in the U.S. policy on Africa. He failed to mention that the U.S. had limited resources to compete with the tens of billions of dollars that China was pouring into Africa. And on the predatory practices of China and Russia that set up debt traps, that just didn't hold ground. Take this piece of news, the fact that China canceled 23 loans to African countries. This silenced the critics that accused Beijing of practicing debt trap diplomacy, that it deliberately lent money to countries that it knows cannot repay the money, with the goal of increasing its political leverage. Meanwhile, the U.S. has fallen out of favor with many African countries. One survey found that 76% of young Africans named China as the foreign power with a positive influence on their lives. When it comes to Russia, the U.S. has accused it of selling arms in exchange for votes at the U.N. Those votes, he added, helped keep strongmen in power, undermined peace and security, and ran counter to the best interests of the African people. Well, if that is the case, then what about the U.S. keeping strongmen in power in monarchies in the Persian Gulf, regimes like Saudi Arabia or Bahrain? South Africa's foreign minister, Naledi Pandor, holds the same view as the South African president when it comes to Russia. She referenced the Soviet Union's championing of anti-apartheid forces compared with Western cooperation with South Africa's former white supremacist regime. The U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, had to come out and defend U.S. interests in Africa, stating that U.S. intentions are not to dictate what African nations should do.
What we seek most of all is a true partnership between the United States and Africa. We don't want an imbalanced or transactional relationship. And our commitment to a stronger partnership with Africa is not about trying to outdo anyone else.
Successive U.S. administrations have tried to penetrate the African political and economic landscape, but it looks like their efforts have not succeeded, lagging one step behind other powers like China and Russia. The Ukraine conflict is clear proof of that. This is one of the occasions that many nations have been reluctant to embrace the West in its campaign to pressure Moscow. But that is not the only time that a considerable portion of an entire continent does not give importance to U.S. pressure. Recently, snubs from key leaders at the Summit of the Americas revealed U.S. President Joe Biden's struggle to assert U.S. leadership in his neighborhood. The issue of U.S. leadership being questioned begs the question, where else is the U.S. leadership under doubt? From Latin America to Africa to West Asia, all the way to Asia and China in particular, the U.S. is losing support from countries around the world. That is why the phrase, the U.S. losing its superpower status, continues to reverberate in many countries. But perhaps one of the tools that the U.S. uses, which has had a strong backlash, making it fall out of favor with many countries, is the use of sanctions and the use of the dollar as a weapon. Many countries view this as a form of bullying for countries to follow U.S. foreign policy, which is probably why the South African president has said, we should not be told by anyone who we can associate with. It was a massacre that was unprecedented, and it highlighted how private U.S. military contractors felt that they were above the law. 15 years ago, these military contractors shot and killed 17 Iraqis, including two children. The massacre, which became known as the Nisour Square Massacre, highlighted what can go wrong when private military contractors are used, especially when it comes to accountability.
We strive for perfection. We try to drive towards the highest standards, but the fog of war and accidents and the bad guys just have to get lucky once.
The U.S. used private military contractors heavily in Iraq and in Afghanistan. Now the new theater of war is Ukraine. Here is an ad for hiring these contractors. Wanted, multilingual former soldiers willing to covertly head into Ukraine for the handsome sum of up to $2,000 per day. Yes, demand is soaring, and there are plenty of people who are signing up. But what are they called? Contractors? Volunteers? Mercenaries? Or paid security workers? Obviously, some are former soldiers with the ability to fight and kill. This leaves plenty of room for mistakes, meaning civilian casualties. Remember when Ukraine's president made this announcement? Zelensky reveals number of foreign volunteers for Ukraine, the first of some 16,000 fighters to have already arrived, the Ukrainian president said. He further added, Ukraine continues to receive weaponry on a daily basis from our partners, from real friends. And the weapons are more and more powerful every day. The very same weapons that are given to these volunteers. So far, the number of so-called volunteers to have joined the Ukrainian armed forces could be as high as 20,000, a figure that could even exceed that. The demographics of these fighters are varied. In all, fighters from Eastern Europe and former Soviet republics constitute the majority of fighters. In terms of Western countries, the greatest number of foreign fighters include the U.S., U.K., Canada, Germany, France, and even some that are coming from Japan. When it comes to the U.S. private military contractors, the one that stands out is Academy, formerly known as Blackwater. Reports have pointed to its involvement in Ukraine. First, reports emerged in July 2021 that Blackwater founder Eric Prince had plans to create a $10 billion private army in Ukraine. His plans included a private army staffed by former Ukrainian combat veterans. However, what is not widely reported was that Academy was involved in Ukraine already since the year 2014. Hundreds of these mercenaries were operating in the country's east and south, but the U.S. has denied these claims. But other Western countries are open in their admission of foreign fighters fighting in Ukraine. Take Germany, for example. Germany's Foreign Office tweet is very telling here. Reports on death sentences against foreign nationals serving in Ukraine's armed forces are shocking. As combatants, they are prisoners of war, entitled to special protections under the Geneva Convention. The UK's involvement has been heavy when it comes to foreign fighters. In June, it was reported how the UK has training centers set up for Ukrainian recruits to train soldiers sent by Kiev, including women, for urban combat. The target for the number of people that the UK can train, 10,000 soldiers every 3 months. Whether they are private military contractors, volunteers, or whatever name they are called, they're fueling the flames of war. It should be mentioned that Russia is also complicit in its use of contractors or mercenaries as well, as it has been reported. The extent and the number, however, is not known. Let's not forget, it wasn't too long ago that the armed groups in Syria were getting help from America, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey. And a source of training for the armed gangs was the notorious U.S. private security firm formerly known as Blackwater. Security circles have long reported that it was sending mercenaries from Iraq into Syria, something which the U.S. stands accused of until this day. Ukraine is becoming eerily similar to Syria, thanks to the U.S. and its European partners, who are keen to make sure that this war continues, from the massive military aid to manpower in the form of these contractors. Pumping Ukraine with weapons has become the main trend for the U.S., leading the Europeans down the same path. So high the volume of these weapons that Ukrainian illegal arms trafficking has become a terrorist threat at an international level. This is just another outcome of the wrong and deadly U.S. foreign policy, in which many Iraqis witnessed 15 years ago, as was the case in the Nusayr Square massacre. The conflict between Azerbaijan and Armenia, after a truce, has blown up again. About 100 soldiers have died in total. This is the worst fighting between the two since the 2020 war. According to Azerbaijan's president, Ilham Aliyev, provocations committed by Armenian forces at the border have been averted and all necessary objectives were fulfilled. It blamed Armenia for the flare-up. It is widely reported that this conflict is due to the dispute over Nagorno-Karabakh region, which two wars have been fought between the former Soviet republics of Armenia and Azerbaijan. A quick history check reveals how ethnic Armenian separatists in Nagorno-Karabakh first broke away from Azerbaijan when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991. The war that broke out afterwards claimed the lives of around 30,000 people. Back in 2020, when another war broke out, which lasted 6 weeks, 6,500 lives were lost. The fighting ended with a Russian-brokered ceasefire. Moscow deployed thousands of peacekeepers in the region to successfully mediate to prevent the war from continuing. The question is, what is behind the most recent flare-up? Azerbaijan needs access to bodies of water in order to provide energy resources to the West, which, given its relationship with Iran, Israel and Western entities would prevent that from happening. Azerbaijan's last 2 years of military action against Armenia is to cut and separate the land route between Iran and Armenia and the direct access to Nakhchivan from the southern area of Siunak or Zangezur Corridor, a concept for a transport corridor which, if implemented, would give Azerbaijan unimpeded access to Nakhchivan. Meanwhile, Israel, the U.S., Russia, and Turkey do have a hand either directly or indirectly in this conflict, all for their own political objectives. Israel is a supporter of Azerbaijan, and as such has strengthened its relationship, especially when it comes to military equipment like drones. This to have a front against Iran. Meanwhile, Iran has always had a diplomatic approach to the conflict. During the past war, it was very telling what Iran said, that renewed fighting between its neighbors, Azerbaijan and Armenia, could escalate into a wider regional war. And this is where the U.S. may have motives behind seeing a renewed conflict. One intention may be to draw Russia into this war in order to weaken its capabilities in the Ukraine conflict. And the U.S. certainly does not mind if Iran's borders are destabilized, leaving that task to its watchdog in the region, namely Israel. The U.S., however, is presenting another side to this provocation. The U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken has said that Russia may have a hand in this conflict, stirring the pot in order to distract from Russia's most recent losses in Ukraine, according to the U.S. point of view.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
As the U.S.-led West involvement has been detrimental in Asia, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization's role in Afghanistan issue has proved to be constructive. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. Stay tuned for more. Global Times wrote, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO, has always paid great attention to the Afghan issue, especially after U.S. hasty withdrawal from Afghanistan in 2021. Many observers from the international community have focused on how the SCO can and will address the hardship Afghanistan faces. Days before the SCO Samarkand summit, which just concluded recently, many foreign media outlets highlighted the Afghan issue as one of the crucial topics for the meeting. Both the remarks delivered by Chinese President Xi Jinping at the 22nd meeting of the SCO Council of Heads of State and the Samarkand Declaration signed by the SCO member states on the same day underlined the Afghan issue, which fully demonstrated the great importance the SCO has attached to Afghanistan. In comparison to the U.S. and Western countries or the blocs headed by them, the SCO's manner in dealing with the Afghan issue is obviously more constructive for Afghanistan and its people. The U.S. and Western countries have always attempted to transform Afghanistan by ideological infiltration and export of Western-style democracy. They tend to support one faction against another by resorting to military means, which has triggered even more violence and conflicts rather than settling them. This can be illustrated by the 20-year war in Afghanistan. What it left for the country has been nothing but complete devastation and more hardships that the Afghan people had to suffer. Yang Jin, an associate research fellow at the Institute of Russian, Eastern European and Central Asian Studies at the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, told the Global Times. Global Times added, by contrast, the SCO, under the guideline of the Shanghai spirit, which features mutual trust, mutual benefit, equality, consultation, respect for diverse civilizations, and pursuit of common development, has always played the role of a promoter, an aid provider, a mediator, as well as a contributor to push the settlement of the Afghan issue. President Xi said at the SCO Samarkand summit that we should ensure that the SCO Afghanistan contact group and the mechanism of coordination and cooperation among Afghanistan's neighbors continue to play their roles. Almost all SCO member states, including China, have participated in various mechanisms to address the Afghan issue, sticking up for Afghanistan's sovereignty and independence, support the Afghan-led and Afghan-owned principle, the peace and reconciliation process in Afghanistan, and not interfere in Afghanistan's internal affairs in the hope of Afghanistan achieving its peaceful development. The Afghan issue is definitely the main concern of the SCO, given its member states' geographic positions, as well as the purpose of the group itself. In terms of geography, almost all SCO members are Afghanistan's peripheral countries. The situation of Afghanistan will certainly affect the security and stability of these countries. Responsible Statecraft on the issue wrote, Washington's coalitions in the Indo-Pacific and elsewhere are failing to gain new adherents. The rise of SCO indicates the potential emergence of Eurasia as a more coordinated actor in global politics, even as significant internal tensions and contradictions remain within its fold. While we hear about NATO almost daily in the mainstream media, the SCO is a much less known entity. With 40% of the world's population and 30% of its GDP, it shouldn't be. Founded in 2001 and headquartered in Beijing, the SCO, while expressly not a military alliance, is today the premier regional organization spanning Eurasia. It emerged from rapprochement between China and Russia in 1990s under contentious border dispute, finally settled in 2005, that also involved three Soviet republics, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and Tajikistan. The border settlement talks continued even after the three republics gained independence upon the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, eventually leading to a comprehensive settlement. Settling the vexed question of territory enabled the five states, joined by Uzbekistan, to lay the groundwork for a new organization. But the SCO did not stop with Central Asia. More recently, it has kicked into expansion mode. Embedded at the core of the SCO are principles of sovereignty and territorial integrity, equality and mutual benefit, resolution of all issues through mutual consultations, non-interference in internal affairs. The organization has also traditionally laid stress on combating terrorism and extremism with multiple joint military exercises in this arena. But the unstated but clear motivation of the SCO is to form a parallel structure of geopolitical like-mindedness to US-led coalitions that dot the global landscape. In attracting major states of the global south, such as India, Pakistan, Turkey, Iran, and Egypt, the expanding SCO is sending a message of gathering East-South convergence. In sum, Washington seems to be doing everything it can to create a more adverse and convergent Eurasia. Apart from the lip service being extended to diplomacy, there seems to be an active attempt underway to undermine the policy. This, in turn, coupled with Chinese nationalism, has had knock-on effects of freezing other types of engagement with Beijing, such as on climate change. The military strategy in Ukraine appears to have no diplomatic counterpart. When it comes to grand strategy, Washington may be its own worst enemy.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Basing country issues on others is wrong. Pay attention to the domestic capacities. This is the part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the president and members of the cabinet in Imam Khomeini's Husseiniyya on August 30th, 2022. Another of your achievements has been your employing the youth in the country's executive sectors. This is a great move, for it opens the worn-out circle of managers, replacing them with a new force. This breathes new life into the country's executive bodies. This is a fantastic thing that's happened. Continue with it. I must also add, though, that I understand and have observed that previously, when I constantly talk about the youth, I knew that they too might make mistakes in certain cases. In both the administration and in the parliament, young people do make mistakes. But the benefits outweighs the cost of these mistakes. It is worth preserving the executive and legislative bodies of the countries being governed by youthful spirits instead of worrying about a few mistakes that might make in certain cases. By the will of God, these mistakes will gradually be resolved. This will result in good, strong leaders. This was another of your accomplishments.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Another great achievement this administration has made is that it has brought our society out of a state of expectation. It has turned people's gaze away from foreigners. It has came out of these states of continuous waiting to see what others have to say about us, or what they will decide for us, or what they are going to do. Importance has been given to domestic capacities, reliance has been placed on these, and work is being done. Some people say we should definitely have relations with a certain country in order to solve our problems, but this is very harmful to our country. Relying on others and waiting for them to solve the country's issues is the wrong approach. Thankfully, such a thing has been minimized to a great extent in your administration.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
King Charles has ascended to the British throne at a time when people in the countries that were once exploited by the British wish the monarchy fade away soon. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. Stay tuned, please. Asia Times wrote, "The death of Queen Elizabeth, the longest-serving monarch of British royalty, has sparked global fascination and spawned thousands of clickbait reports of the details of her funeral. Americans who centuries ago rejected monarchy are seemingly obsessed with the ritualism, bizarrely mourning the demise of an elderly and fabulously wealthy woman who was born into privilege and who died of natural causes at the ripe old age of 96 across the ocean. Perhaps this is because popular and long-running TV shows about British royalty like The Crown have convinced that we know intimate details about the royals, and worse, they cause us to believe we should care about a family that is a symbolic marker of past imperial grandeur. But for those who are descended from the subjects of British imperialist conquest, the Queen, her ancestors, and her descendants represent the ultimate evil empire." One could argue that Elizabeth, who was gifted the throne and its title in 1952, did not lead an aggressive empire of conquest and instead presided over an institution that, under her rule, became largely symbolic and ceremonial in nature. And indeed, many do just that. Raoul Mahajan, author of Full Spectrum Dominance and The New Crusade, has a different opinion, referring in an interview to Elizabeth as a morally unremarkable person with a job that involved doing extremely unremarkable things. Mahajan explains further, saying that this was a highly privileged person given an opportunity to influence world events in some degree, which she had to do nothing to earn, who never did anything particularly remarkable, innovative, or insightful. While Elizabeth's 7 years on the throne were mostly spent overseeing an ostensible unraveling of British Empire in a world less intolerant of occupation, enslavement, and imperial plunder, just a few months into her role as queen, the British violently put down the Mau Mau rebellion in Kenya. According to New York Times, a story about how citizens in African nations today have little sympathy for the dead monarch, the squashing of the rebellion led to the establishment of a vast system of detention camps and torture, rape, castration, and killing of thousands of people. Even if Elizabeth was not responsible for directing the horrors, they were carried out in her name. Over the 7 decades that she wielded symbolic power, she never once apologized for what was done during her rule in Kenya, or indeed what was done in her family's name in dozens of other nations in the global south. It's no wonder that black and brown people the world over have openly expressed disgust at the collective fawning of such an ugly legacy. Professor Uju Anya of Carnegie Mellon University, who is Nigerian, is under fire for her frank dismissal of Elizabeth after posting on Twitter that she heard the chief monarch of a thieving and raping genocidal empire is finally dying. May her pain be excruciating. Kehinde Andrews, a black studies professor at Birmingham City University, wrote on Politico that he cannot relate to his fellow Britons' desire to mourn Elizabeth, a woman he considered to be the number one symbol of white supremacy and a manifestation of the institutional racism that we have to encounter on a daily basis. According to the New York Times, as Prince Charles used tax breaks, offshore accounts, and canny real estate investments to turn a sleepy state into a billion-dollar business, the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists in 2017 found that both Elizabeth and Charles were named in the leaked Paradise Papers, indicating that they hid their money in havens to avoid paying taxes. Fleecing taxpayers and living off stolen wealth, monarchy's original modus operandi appears to be central to Elizabeth's legacy. One, she passes on to her son, who also won't pay an inheritance tax on the wealth she left him. The British monarchy, according to Mahajan, mostly represents a real concession to the idea that some people are just born better and more important than you, and you should look to them. It's a good time for the popularity of this institution to fade away soon.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Free pigeons for a world free of war. Iran's War University hosted the director of the United Nations Information Center in Iran, Inger Marie Veniz, along with military attaches from different embassies. To attend this ceremony, dubbed the Book of Peace and Defense, which is themed with the 1980s Iran-Iraq War. The UNIC head read out a statement from United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres during the event.
Time to observe 24 hours of non-violence and ceasefire, we renew our call for all people to do more than lay down their weapons.
This event comes on the occasion of the National Sacred Defense Week, which marks the beginning of the 1980 to 1988 Iran-Iraq War, the longest armed conflict of the 20th century, which was waged by the then Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein and heavily funded by the West. Every year on the occasion, the Islamic Republic holds nationwide ceremonies to highlight its resistance against the Iraqi forces.
At that time, the Ba'athist regime, and on top of it, Saddam Hussein, was fully supported by numerous Western countries. The war continued for 8 years, but we fought the invaders and did not give an inch of our soil to them. So today, we as veterans feel bound to transfer our expertise and tactics to the new generation to preserve our defense might.
Saddam Hussein failed to make any achievement in his war against Iran, but the humanitarian effects of the offensive are still lingering in Iran, with many war veterans continuing to reel from exposure to chemical substances used by Iraqi forces. Those chemical materials were reportedly supplied by a number of German, French, and Dutch corporations.
The Islamic Republic takes great pride in how it defended the country during the Iraqi-imposed war, calling it the sacred defense and a drive for its present self-sufficiency in the military sector. Meanwhile, Tehran holds this annual commemoration ceremony as a chance to promote peace and shed light on the dark consequences of war. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Amid international calls for renewing the UN brokered truce, the Yemeni Center for Human Rights has held a press conference in Sana'a to release a report titled The Alleged Truce. The report highlights the Saudi-led coalition's violations of the UN agreement since it was brokered in April.
Saudi Arabia's violations were committed from the first day of the war, but they continued even under the UN truce. The most important violations were the non-compliance with the terms of the truce, which included reducing the number of scheduled flights and specifying only one destination instead of two, as well as the continued detention of fuel ships. There is a breach on the essence of the agreement.
The report says the Saudi-led coalition has committed over 14,000 violations, including waging 278 airstrikes, which led to the death of Yemeni civilians.
As a human rights center, we affirm that the most important violations are the loss of life. Unfortunately, during the truce, 70 Yemeni civilians, including women and children, were killed. The siege has also continued during the truce. This has caused the deaths of thousands of civilians due to the lack of fuel in hospitals.
Recently, the UN Security Council urged warring sites in Yemen to extend the truce, saying it has had tangible benefits for the humanitarian situation in the war-torn country. So far, there are no signs of agreement from both parties.
A complete end to the war and siege is what Yemenis are demanding from the international community, including the United Nations. They say the temporary truce should not be extended since the world body has failed to ensure its full implementation. Al-Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
British police have found themselves embroiled in another racism scandal, this time surrounding the killing of an unarmed black man in South London by armed officers on the 5th of September. Following an alleged police pursuit, 24-year-old Chris Carber was behind the wheel of a car hemmed in by two police vehicles in a narrow street before one round was fired, ending his life. He leaves behind a fiancée and an unborn child. No gun was found in the car.
Thousands of protesters have descended outside police headquarters in central London to vent their fury over what they say is gross injustice being carried out by the authorities against Chris and his family. Accusations are swirling around, some of which include that the police who stopped Chris on that fateful day may have known who was inside the car in the lead-up to the fatal shooting. This is, of course, all being investigated, but the protest organizers have made absolutely clear that they are going to refuse to back down until the demands of the family are met and justice be served.
Fighting back the tears, family members spoke of their ordeal after seeing the body for the first time since the killing. News of the shooting has caused uproar, especially in the black community. They feel this was just another example of a racist system out to harm them. Following the backlash, the officer responsible for the shooting has been suspended. An investigation is also underway, but the police watchdog warned it could take 9 months to reach a conclusion. The family expressed anger at the lengthy wait. However, the question of race playing a role will be examined as a factor, providing some small hope that the family's demands will be answered. Robert Carter, London.
Palestinian protesters took to the streets in the blockaded Gaza Strip following the Friday prayers to condemn Israeli raids on Al-Aqsa Mosque in the occupied city of Al-Quds. Angry protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli